Tonight, a special night with Dr. Michael Sala. You know, there are some who believe that there are extraterrestrials walking among us right now. We'll talk about the expert in exopolitics in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Michael Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. He's the author of several books that include Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence. Dr. Sala was an assistant professor, researcher, and residence in the School of International Service at the American University from 96 to 2004, chased out, I might say, because of his involvement in investigating UFOs. He has a PhD in the government from the University of Queensland, Australia. He's also the founder of the Exopolitics Institute, a not-for-profit organization that analyzes the political implications of the extraterrestrial presence. He's our guest on Coast to Coast. Michael, welcome back.
Aloha, George. I'm glad to be back.
Likewise. Gosh, I remember that night that your tenure at the university was in jeopardy because of your involvement in investigating UFOs. And remember we tried to get everybody to bombard the university for you?
That's right, George, yes. It was basically came out of the research I'd done on the Eisenhower meeting with extraterrestrials. The Washington Post ran a feature story on that, and that got me into trouble with the university, who weren't pleased with the attention I was getting.
We hear the word exopolitics quite often, but it has some different meanings. But to you, Michael, what does it mean?
Well, the simplest definition I use is just the political implications of the extraterrestrial presence. I mean, there's a more formal definition I use, which is the study of the key actors, institutions, and processes associated with the extraterrestrial presence.
Tonight we're going to talk about the theories of extraterrestrials living among us. First of all, in your research, Michael, how far back have you gone in terms of looking at the visitations?
Well, that's a really fascinating question, George. I initially began to look at some of the contactee reports from the 50s and 60s and compiling whatever evidence I could find from various documents, testimonies, photos, and that sort of thing. And then I began to connect the pieces with some of the work that Zechariah Sitchin had done and the other religious texts that I had come across pointing to the ancient extraterrestrial presence. And I suddenly realized that, well, the ancients were actually talking about the same phenomenon of extraterrestrials living amongst us. It wasn't just extraterrestrials visiting us, even though you have those kinds of descriptions in various books, Ezekiel, various authors historically talk about visitors from the skies coming in their vehicles, but actually we also have reports of extraterrestrials living amongst us. So that's another category, and that was something I became very interested in.
Do you believe then that mankind, since our true inception, of course, some of us believe we've been genetically altered, and that's how we all got here in the first place, but do you believe that these visitations have been occurring since almost the beginning of time, maybe even before mankind has been on this planet?
Well, they certainly have been present since the earliest recorded histories. When we look at some of the key historical authors, they mention these beings that lived amongst us that were in fact deemed to be the rulers, or they described them in those days as god kings. And we have a number of different authors and documents reporting the same phenomenon from Egypt through to Sumeria, India, South America, and so this is a phenomenon that was worldwide, and that to me suggests that when we go even further back than recorded history, we'd probably find the same phenomenon, but obviously the only documents we have are from recorded history, and so we have to go to the Sumerian records, the biblical records, and so forth.
Though we get extraterrestrial sightings, and we get reports, and we get some UFO flaps, why was there more involvement back thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years ago?
Well, I think because the extraterrestrials were actually the rulers. They were the elites. This is quite startling when you really contemplate the implications of this. We look at a few documents and a few historians that describe this. One is Manetho, the ancient Egyptian historian, who lived in the 4th century BC, And he is an authority for what is conventionally known as the 30 dynasties. This is what contemporary archaeologists use to get information about the rule of ancient Egypt, and so they look at these 30 dynasties for the key figures, how long they ruled for, some of the key events from their lives. And Manetho is accepted as an accurate authority on those figures. But Manetho didn't just talk about the 30 dynasties of human rulers. He talked about the ancient god kings, and he described 8 of them. And these 8 god kings basically preceded another group of 8 rulers that he described as demigods. And then these were basically the hybrids or the offshoots of these gods, these first 8 gods, mixing with the human population. And so what we have here really is an amazing example of how the ancient civilization of Egypt actually knew about these visitors. They described them as god kings. They came from other worlds. They were aware of this, and there were 8 of them that ruled for quite extended periods of time. And they were then followed by another 8 demigods, and then you had the beginning of the 30 dynasties that Manetho described.
What do they look like, Michael?
Well, the description that the ancient Egyptians had for these beings were that they were typically godlike, very, very large, very tall. They had,
but not reptilian heads or anything like that.
No, no. Well, actually, when we look at the Egyptian records, you typically have them having different sorts of heads. Now, whether that described actual qualities as opposed to them being actually humanoid with, say, the head of a falcon. So, for example, we have the king Ra, or the sun god Helios, as was known in the ancient Greek mythology. And so he was described as a humanoid being, but he had this kind of bird-like head. And same with some of these other rulers. Now, that might describe qualities that they had. I mean, typically the hawk, the eagle, and so forth have these, as we in contemporary society view these animals as having particular qualities, and so we ascribe those qualities to people or organizations venerating or having those symbols on flags. So, for example, you know, the United States with the eagle, and the eagle depicting the prowess and the far-sighted vision and so forth. And so we might consider those humanoids from ancient Egypt with the different figures or the different heads of birds as being representations of the qualities. But certainly they were humanoid.
I had Stanton Friedman on with me last week, Michael, and he was talking about the Betty and Barney Hill case, and I think he's convinced that our visitations have occurred from the Zeta Reticuli area, and that they're grays. I would assume you think they're coming from another spot.
Well, yes, I do. I think that they come from much further back in our history, that they have been coming in and out of human civilization, playing prominent roles and sometimes less prominent roles. And I referred to Egypt as being one example. Of course, we know about Zechariah Sitchin and the Anunnaki and his descriptions. And of course, there is an ancient historical document that describes the god kings of the Anunnaki, and that is the king lists, and that's a 4,000-year-old document, and that describes the various kings of ancient Sumeria and how they came from the heavens. And so that's confirmation for the thesis that Zechariah Sitchin has, that these beings not only came from other star systems, but they actually lived amongst us and were rulers. And these were human-looking beings. The descriptions that Zechariah Sitchin has of these were that they were human-looking and that they actually interbred with humanity and that they spawned giants. So, you know, we are talking about beings that are completely different to the Zeta Reticuli, who are typically 3 foot, 4 foot tall, who appear to be suffering some kind of genetic degeneration and are looking for human DNA to somehow restore the vitality of their race. We're talking about extraterrestrial beings who, in relation to us, were giants. And some of these descriptions of them are as tall as 40 feet. So these are quite incredible beings, genetically much more robust than even we are, and so they are very different to the Zeta Reticuli.
How come we don't find their skeletons? I know there's this Snopes-type picture that we see from Saudi Arabia of a giant that they claim to have uncovered. I don't believe that's real.
Well, there have been a number of scholars, researchers that do look at the ancient records, anthropological evidence that they've found around the planet, and they do discuss the records going back many, many centuries, or thousands of years, Michael Cremo and forbidden archaeology being one example.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's got some great subject matter.
And so he dates human-looking beings going back millions of years, not just the 300,000 that conventional scholarship describes Homo sapiens as originating. And some of those skulls are made available, or that researchers such as Michael Cremo can get to have a look at them, but they're kind of kept away, sequestered away from most of the conventional public. There also have been recorded findings of giants, and these are from, I guess, the United States, and in many countries there are fossil records of these, but there are certain archaeologists or anthropologists who have specialized in that.
It does. Does anybody else out there support the Zachariah Sitchin's theories of the Anunnaki, the Visitation, Nibiru, the 10th planet?
Well, there are a number of researchers, Neil Freer, Alan Alford, and a few others support the idea of the Anunnaki visitors, and they do use the translations that Zechariah Sitchin has provided. Now, of course, from the conventional scholarship point of view, the perspective is that these were merely myths, that the Sumerians were describing a mythological worldview in terms of the Anunnaki and these visitors from other worlds coming here and interbreeding or spawning human civilization. And that's similar to the way in which Manetho's description of the god kings or the gods prior to the 30 dynasties, that conventional archaeologists regard those as also being myths. And so that's the big stumbling block for many of those in academia looking at some of these issues, that when you look at the actual texts, that whether it's Manetho or the cuneiform texts that Zechariah Sitchin has translated, they might agree with the translation. And even there are differences. But even if they agree with the translation, I'll just turn around and say, well, these are just myths. That was not real. And that's the worldview that really prevents many of the conventional archaeologists taking that seriously.
And you do not believe, because my question was going to be, if Sitchin is correct, why did they leave? You don't think they left, do you?
Well, I think there was a process here whereby they gradually became less prominent in society. Why that is, I'm not exactly sure, but both the king lists and Manetho described the king, the god kings, these were essentially extraterrestrial visitors, at a certain point ending their direct rule, and then there was a stage where you had these demigods who were kind of like the interbreeding of these gods with humans, and so you had beings that were a fusion.
Was it like a parent with a child, and then after a few years, the kid's on its own?
Something like that. And then eventually even these demigods were replaced by human rulers. And what appears to be the big dividing line, or the event for all of this to happen, was a deluge or a great flood.
Yes.
So many thousands of years ago.
The flood we know of as the flood of Noah, right?
That's right. That's exactly the way in which Zechariah Sitchin describes this. And also we have historical texts too, like the Book of Enoch, and that describes the way in which the Nephilim, as they are described, were eventually replaced by human rulers, and that this it's depicted in some kind of biblical battle between the fallen angels and the righteous angels. But the flood was essentially a mechanism that the Book of Enoch describes as being the way in which the divine creator with the righteous angels cleansed the planet of these fallen angels and their offspring, who were giants, cleansed the planet, saved a few righteous men, Noah and so forth, and then started over again.
Michael, do you believe fallen angels were extraterrestrials as opposed to spiritual beings?
I think that they were definitely extraterrestrial visitors. When we look at the Book of Enoch, the way it describes these beings, it really is a description of, they describe them as Nephilim, fallen angels who took a liking to the women, and they interbred with them. And it described the number of them. It described 200 of them. So we are talking about 200 fallen angels, according to the Book of Enoch.
That would have come here, what, in a craft of some type?
Well, it didn't describe how they appeared here. I mean,
no.
The Book of Enoch isn't clear about that, but essentially they came through some mechanism, whether they just...
A portal? Maybe a portal?
It may have been a portal. It may have been what others have described, that these were essentially kind of rebels or recalcitrant extraterrestrials from other worlds that weren't wanted. I mean, a number of contactees have described these fallen angels as kind of stragglers or people who, or beings that couldn't fit into the more peaceful, harmonious lives on these other worlds, and they were kind of left here. So in a sense, the Earth was an early prison, if you like, or a place of exile.
Well, all I know, something dramatic happened, Michael, whether it's the spiritual type of angelic intervention through another dimension or extraterrestrials that may have come here. There's no question that something happened that had such a profound effect on humanity. The storytelling is also phenomenal about how it is just passed on and on and on throughout various civilizations. Have you found that to be the case, that ancient societies scattered around this planet talk about similar things?
Well, that's right. And I think as a scholar, that's what you look for. You look for cross-referencing. You're not satisfied with just one case, one explanation. If it were, for example, what we had was Sitchin and his descriptions of the Anunnaki and how they established a presence here and became rulers, you know, we could raise questions about, well, you know, this is really maybe what conventional scholars say. It is just myth. But when you find the same process in Egypt, when you find the same thing described in biblical texts of Israel, Palestine, when you find the same process with the Indian Hindu traditions and the Vibhanas, then what you see is that this was something happening independently across the planet. We have independent sources describing the same phenomenon, and to me, as a scholar, that is very strong evidence that we have a phenomenon that occurred in ancient times that was very real.
Did we lose it somehow, or is it still here?
Well, that's an intriguing question. I certainly think that there was some process whereby that direct rule of these god kings, these extraterrestrial beings, was no longer necessary. Now, why that is, we can speculate about that, but nevertheless, they withdrew and then they had influence through their offspring or the kind of intermarriage between humans and these extraterrestrials, and then that itself was replaced by human rulers. And what we can speculate here is that probably what happened was that the extraterrestrials didn't withdraw altogether. They just withdrew into the background and essentially ruled through these proxy human kings.
Do you think they may have gone underground? We'll talk with you about that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Michael Sala. Michael, when you say they kind of withdrew from, I guess, controlling mankind, and we wonder where they may have gone. Could they have gone underground?
Well, I think there was definitely a process whereby some of them may have left altogether and others went underground, in the sense that they simply weren't as visible as they once were, and they were ruling through proxy rulers. This is something William Bramley has talked about in The Gods of Eden, and also Jim Mars in Rule by Secrecy. When we look at the history of human civilization, you can see these patterns pointing to conventional rulers being really proxies for someone else ruling through them. And I think that's something, that's a case that William Bramley makes, I think, better than anyone else. And it points directly to these extraterrestrials who once were the elite or were the rulers, but had somehow gone underground for whatever reason. They chose not to rule directly. And perhaps that may have been because it was easier to rule from behind the scenes than out front, where people may have been disturbed or may have rebelled.
What do you think of the theories of David Icke, where he believes that humankind may have been influenced by these reptilian figures, in that these reptilians basically have shapeshifted to all our leaders, you know, these families, the bloodlines of these families that have taken over. And he claims that if you look at some of these people, you begin to see reptilian eyes.
Well, I think there's certainly evidence that there has been a reptilian presence going way back into antiquity. There are a number of authors, such as Arthur Horn, who talk about humanity's extraterrestrial origins, and they do point to this reptilian presence. And we can see figures, even some of the figures from ancient Sumeria, depicting reptilian beings. Also, some of the ancient texts, biblical texts, also talk about serpent-like figures that were present in the Garden of Eden. So we could probably find enough evidence that there has been a genuine reptilian presence going way back into humanity's past. Now, as for the shapeshifters, that's another thesis, and it's certainly something that I would like to get a lot more evidence to support, because I think there may be other techniques that are used for non-human-looking extraterrestrials who are still present on the planet. They may use technology in some form rather than some kind of shape-shifting ability that's dependent on having some kind of human blood flowing through them, as David Icke is arguing.
I'm going to get back to the presence in a second, but let's talk about your work, Michael, in the evidence you seek out to put together some of the things that we're talking about tonight and some of your other theories with exopolitics. Where do you go to find your sources? Where do you go for the truth, for the evidence?
Well, I look at a number of different sources here. Those classic contactee cases from the 50s and 60s, many of them have died, and so there's very little that we can do in terms of directly interviewing them, but they left behind a collection of interviews, books, photographs, and so we can look at that. We can look at the work of other researchers who investigated these cases, and for example, I rely quite a bit on Timothy Good, who did research some of the classic contactee cases from the 50s. In particular, I'm talking about George Adamski,
right,
Howard Menger, Daniel Fry, who all are controversial. UFO researchers regard them all in a very controversial light. But I think Timothy Good is probably one of the very few UFO researchers who really is open-minded. He isn't out to debunk these people. He'll go out, he'll do the field work, he'll go and visit them, he'll check out their evidence, their photographs, and I think that's the way a researcher has to be. If these people are alive, you go and interview them. You basically look them in the eye, ask them the questions, look at their body language, and that way you're able to tell quite a bit as to whether or not they're telling you the truth or not. And so we rely on those kinds of cases, and also for those who are still alive, we are fortunate to be able to interview them, and that's something that I've been doing as well, interviewing some of the contactees in person.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that. What do they tell you? Give us some examples.
Well, some of the information that they have to share is quite remarkable. One of the contactees that I have met is Frank Strangers, who is resident there in Los Angeles, up in Chatsworth, mm-hmm. and I've spoken to him a couple of times, and because he's got an amazing story concerning Valiant Thor having been an extraterrestrial guest of the Pentagon. And what makes his case intriguing is that there was, in fact, this connection between Valiant Thor and Howard Mengo, who was one of the contactees that Timothy Good believed had enough evidence to warrant him as being regarded as credible in some of the things he was saying. So Howard Mengo was someone who hosted these conventions at his property in High Bridge, New Jersey in the 50s. And in one of these conventions in 1957, a UFO researcher and photographer by the name of August Roberts took some photos of some guests who claimed that they were extraterrestrial visitors. And so he passed these photos on to people, and they found their way to Frank Strangers, who showed the photos to a number of people at his UFO lectures. And what eventually happened was that he says that he was given the opportunity to meet with one of those extraterrestrial visitors. And he says it was someone from the Pentagon who came and gave him that opportunity, and he accepted. And so he found his way to the Pentagon and then met with the same extraterrestrial who was in this photo by August Roberts. So Frank Strange's testimony corroborates that particular photograph that August Roberts had of an extraterrestrial visitor. And I've spoken to Frank Strangers, had a couple of interviews with him, mm-hmm. and he certainly strikes me as someone that's very sincere, and he's telling the truth as he believes it.
Yeah, he's been with us before, and I think you're right about that. He seems sincere.
Definitely, and one of the things that any UFO researcher who looks at these contactee cases soon discovers is that there's a phenomenon here that's really hard to put your finger on, in terms of a person can be very sincere and they can report on their experiences as they recollect them. But that doesn't mean that it happened exactly the way they remember it. I mean, there are all sorts of things that need to be introduced here, and I think this goes across the board when we're talking about contactees who have these experiences with extraterrestrial visitors and go and report this to the general public and get public attention. You know, I think we need to bring in a discussion of what is the national security response to this. I mean, for example, if Frank Strangers did meet with a visitor, an extraterrestrial who was a host of the Pentagon, would he be allowed to simply go out and talk about this exactly as it occurred, or would there be something that may have been required or something that may have interfered with his memories of what occurred, so that later researchers would look at some discrepancies and therefore dismiss the case out of hand? Because I think that's what has been a major part of the secrecy system, that those that do have contact experiences, often in recounting the events, there are discrepancies, and people pick up on these discrepancies and dismiss the case altogether. And that's what's happened with Frank Strangers. It's happened with George Adamski, Mengo, and many other contactees.
I believe it's Michael Hind who does not believe in Zechariah Sitchin's work. I think he takes a more biblical approach, and I guess there's some people like that.
Well, that's right. I think some people want to look at the evidence closely, and I think it's just a different mindset, and I think it's partly a result of a person's background. I think, say, someone from the natural sciences would want to look at the evidence as it is and really isn't interested in entertaining these ideas that, well, national security agencies have come in and fudged the evidence and somehow kind of erased it or manipulated or intimidated people. You know, they're not interested in that. They're really interested in showing me the evidence. I want to analyze it in a lab where I can corroborate what's been said. And if I can't corroborate it, well, then it's unsubstantiated and the person may be hoaxing it. I mean, that's the approach of certain physical scientists. Now, someone from a political science background, such as myself, you look at the bigger picture, and one of the things that immediately you begin to explore is, well, what is the national security implications of this? If there are national security implications, would that mean that various government agencies would come in and manipulate and interfere with the evidence? And I think that that in fact, has been happening regularly, and I think Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project really proves or really does demonstrate for anyone that is objective that, in fact, there has been quite a lot of tampering and manipulation that has been occurring at an official level.
Why does it seem that, you know, in the field of ufology, we can take one step forward and sometimes two steps back? We get close, but not close enough. We get close to disclosure, not close enough. Why does that happen?
Well, I think there are different methodologies used amongst UFO researchers here, and I did mention the those that want to look at the hard evidence and nothing but the hard evidence. And so if someone, a whistleblower or contactee, comes forward and makes a claim, and that claim is not substantiated by the evidence, then they will dismiss it. And a really good example of this is Philip Corso, who, as I'm sure you and your viewers know, was someone that worked at the Pentagon in the Office of Foreign Technology, and he was the head of the Foreign Technology Desk. He claims he was the head of the Foreign Technology Desk for 2 years. Now, when the archival research was done and documents were found, what they found was that, in fact, he was head of the Foreign Technology Desk for 3 months, but he was there for 2 years. And so what some researchers will do is say, well, you know, Corso said he was head of the desk for 2 years. Documents only said he was head of the desk, Foreign Technology Desk, for 3 months. Mm-hmm. So he's embellishing. We can't take anything he says seriously because this is someone who really is unreliable. And they'll dismiss the case.
Well, because they find one or two inaccuracies.
Well, that's right. And I think if you have that mindset, if you're going to scrutinize the minutiae of the evidence and of the background and documentation that any whistleblower or contactee has, eventually you're going to find some discrepancies, or you're going to find something that doesn't quite fit. And if you're of a particular mindset, you will say, well, this really makes the person's testimony unreliable and we need to jettison it. Whereas others will be much more open and say, well, look, Corso was referring to him being in charge of the Foreign Technology Desk, regardless of what was officially recorded, because this was a man who was in charge of an entire military base in his career. So it's certainly not beyond any kind of difficulty in believing that he headed a small desk that was covert in the Foreign Technology Division of the Pentagon.
Tell us a little bit about this Eisenhower case that you were investigating.
Well, the Eisenhower case is really quite amazing. There are a number of meetings President Eisenhower had attended. Recently, there has been some evidence that has emerged from Vatican sources that a source within the Vatican, within the Jesuit order, has come forward to say that a secret organization was created in the Vatican, that's the Servizio Informazione Vaticano, that's SIV, and that was created as a consequence of Eisenhower meeting with extraterrestrials in the presence of the bishop or the cardinal of Los Angeles at the time, Cardinal McIntyre, who flew from Edwards Air Force Base to Rome to brief Pope Pius on what was happening. And as a consequence of that, this secret Vatican organization was created to monitor the extraterrestrial visitation and what exactly was happening in the United States. There was also another interesting aspect to this Eisenhower meeting with extraterrestrials. I had a whistleblower contact me who shared some information concerning him being a medic at Holloman Air Force Base in 1955, where he says Air Force One flew in, Eisenhower got out, proceeded to meet with a delegation of extraterrestrials.
Amazing.
And there was between 500 to 600 personnel who witnessed the UFOs, the flying saucers, and the meeting were taken into the hangars, into the large hangars, and briefed in numbers of 220 at a time, according to this whistleblower. And they were sworn to secrecy. They were basically debriefed that none of this could ever be released. And so this is another example of just how these meetings were occurring at an official level between President Eisenhower and extraterrestrials.
You mean some of these pictures that we see in the National Enquirer of an alien shaking hands with a president? You mean they might be real?
Well, those pictures, I don't know about those pictures, but there was definitely a film taken of Eisenhower meeting with the extraterrestrials. This is something that the Jesuit mentioned, and also one of the Disclosure Project witnesses, Don Phillips, I believe it was, who said that they were aware of this film of Eisenhower meeting with the extraterrestrials. So there is film, and so maybe the National Enquirer is able to get some kind of inside information there.
If this is true, if these meetings took place, why? What was the deal that was cut, Michael?
Well, I think that the first meeting that Eisenhower had in February 20 of 1954, that occurred 9 days before the Bravo test, which was the largest ever hydrogen bomb test of the United States. I think that what had happened was that the extraterrestrials were wanting the United States to abandon its program to develop thermonuclear weapons. Now, if we go back in history, we see that in November of 1953, President Eisenhower went before the United Nations and presented his Adams for Peace proposal, whereby the whole nuclear arsenal and nuclear technology and development would be placed under UN supervision for the benefit of the whole world.
Right.
And the Soviet Union said no. They were not going to be a part of this, that they were going to go ahead and develop their own thermonuclear weapons. And I think that basically meant that Eisenhower was really caught in a really difficult situation, because I believe he had been contacted by extraterrestrials who requested that the U.S. not go ahead with thermonuclear weapons development. The Soviet Union said no, and I think Eisenhower's national security advisors said, we cannot put an end to this. If the Soviet Union is going to develop these weapons, we need to go ahead regardless of what the extraterrestrials want. And I think that meeting in February 19 of 1954, that was the last effort by the extraterrestrials to put an end to the thermonuclear weapons development. And Eisenhower, I think, as some of the witnesses have said, was essentially outvoted by his national security advisors who would not abandon these weapons.
Well, but why then didn't the extraterrestrials do something of a more violent nature?
Well, we have a number of whistleblowers who have come forward and talked about what the extraterrestrials did to really retard and delay the development of these weapons and really make it difficult for the U.S. and the Soviet Union to go ahead with the deployment and the testing of these weapons and the possible escalation into a nuclear war. For example, Robert Salas, who was a captain in a strategic air command base up in Montana, he described an incident where UFOs came and deactivated 7 Minuteman nuclear missiles back in 1963, I believe, around that time, and that this occurred at another base nearby. And so in all, there were 17 nuclear Minuteman missiles that were deactivated for a certain amount of time. And this is not only Robert. There's also other whistleblowers who have talked about a similar deactivation of nuclear weapons by UFOs.
Let's talk about the Georgia Dempsey case when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, he was born in 1891. He died in 1965. Georgia Dembski, a Polish-born American who became notable, known in the fields of ufology, after he claimed to have photographed ships from other planets, met with space brothers, and to have taken flights with them. He's considered himself to be a philosopher, a teacher, a student, a saucer researcher. He was born, of course, in Poland, as I mentioned, in 1891, and he came to America, settled in New York City, right around at the age of 22 years old. In October of 1946, during a meteor shower, Adamski and some of his friends claimed that while they were at the Palomar Gardens campground, they witnessed a large cigar-shaped mothership. Adamski took a photo of what he claimed was the 1946 cigar-shaped mothership crossing in front of the moon. The rest is history. Michael, what can you tell us about this guy?
Well, Adamski, as you just mentioned, he was first known because he took photographs using his telescope, and these photographs were very high quality, and they showed all sorts of anomalous phenomena out either by the moon or elsewhere, and this was something that he was able to put out, and a lot of people got to look at some of his evidence and saw that this was certainly something quite extraordinary. But he then became known as a contactee when he had an encounter in November of 1952, which was just not that long after the very first test of the hydrogen bomb by the United States. That was on November 1st of 1952. So Adamski had a meeting with extraterrestrials that was witnessed by six people who signed affidavits confirming that that they saw Adamski go into the desert and rendezvous with an extraterrestrial who hopped out of a shuttlecraft that had landed. And they witnessed this, and they basically signed their names to the affidavit, and they reported it to the media. And so that was a very credible event, and really that is something that many researchers such as Timothy Good have looked at as being something that helps confirm the testimony that Adamski had of his subsequent encounters with extraterrestrials living amongst us.
He believes they were from Venus, right?
That's correct, yes. Adamski and many of the other contactees mentioned that the extraterrestrials came from the inner solar system, Venus, Mars, Saturn, and that's something I can go into a little into more detail with you, if you like, in terms of how reliable that is, given what science tells us about these planets being.
Yeah, I'd like you, but at this point in this era, the early 50s, did people think of him as a quack? Because he described that this pilot from Venus named Orthon, was of medium humanoid height, long blonde hair, tanned skin, communicated with him via telepathy, told him about the dangers of nuclear war, and to have arranged for Adamski to be taken on a trip to the solar system, including the planet Venus, a location where Mrs. Adamski had been reincarnated.
Well, the thing is, Adamski had a lot of evidence, a lot of hard evidence that people look to in terms of determining how credible someone is. He had photographs. He had eyewitnesses. He even had plaster casts of the footprint of Orthon at their first desert encounter meeting. So this was all evidence that helped him substantiate many of his later claims, which were much more fantastic in terms of being taken up on the ships and going off planet. And the ones that really interested me were his claims concerning these extraterrestrials living amongst us, and that in fact that they referred to themselves as contact men who lived on Earth for a number of years doing the things that any person does in terms of getting a job, getting money, buying clothes, and leading a life that would essentially be blending in with the human population. And to my mind, this is extraordinary, because what we have is not just extraterrestrials visiting us in their ships and then taking people off for incredible experiences and then moving back to their locations out in space, but actually living amongst us, kind of like an interplanetary peace corps. And that, to my mind, was the most amazing part of Adamski's testimony.
Now, you talk about Timothy Good. Did he believe the Adamski story?
He believed parts of the Adamski story were true. He interviewed Adamski on a number of occasions. He interviewed a lot of the witnesses that saw these events associated with Adamski, so he was able to confirm that Adamski was telling the truth. He didn't buy everything Adamski said, but he certainly believed that a number of the incidents that Adamski had described in terms of meeting with extraterrestrial visitors were credible based on his confirmation of various witnesses who saw these things.
Did they have polygraph tests then? I don't know.
I think that I actually can't really answer that question. I don't know when the polygraph tests were taken, but certainly the six witnesses who were present at his very first meeting in 1952 signed affidavits. So these were legal documents saying that what they described was the truth, and essentially if they were lying, they could have been prosecuted because these affidavits were things that they released to the public, and they actually went to the press and the media. So if they were conducting or part of a fraud, there could have been hefty legal consequences for them. So these were people who definitely believed that Adamski had met with an extraterrestrial that alighted from a shuttlecraft in November of 1952.
I don't know how he took that famous picture with his 6-inch telescope, because for years I could never get something that was moving in a telescope, let alone take a picture of it.
Well,
I think it was just hovering there?
Maybe.
I don't know.
I think Adamski was proficient enough with telescopes to be able to capture photos of some really amazing phenomena. And, of course, it's associated with the moon, and that's something that is very significant. But one of the other things that I want to point out about Adamski, and this relates to our earlier conversation concerning President Eisenhower, was Adamski was actually invited to meet with Pope Pius. And if, in fact, Eisenhower did meet with extraterrestrials and the bishop or Cardinal McIntyre had gone to brief Pope Pius, I think that would have given him a lot of interest in what Adamski was claiming in terms of being taken up into these ships and meeting with the extraterrestrials.
Well, it is a remarkable story. Of course, when he died, did he have much fanfare there, or did he quietly just pass on?
Well, the interesting thing about that was that he was buried at Arlington National Cemetery, which typically is not something that's open to just any serviceman. I mean, he was a serviceman, I think, in the Second World War, and so he was someone that certainly was regarded as patriotic and loyal, but that wouldn't have been sufficient to get buried at Arlington National Cemetery. And some of the reports were that every time Adamski had one of these encounters with his extraterrestrials, he would be flown to the Pentagon, and he would brief the Pentagon about what he experienced. And so because he did that over a number of years and had a lot of friends in the Pentagon, I think that they kind of did that as a favor to him, just to honor him.
So they were interested in what was happening to him.
Well, I think this is one of the things about what happens at an official level, that even though officially what we hear is that the Air Force and other agencies, government agencies, will kind of be very skeptical and debunk these contactee reports and UFO sightings in public, at a private level, they are very interested in what is happening, and that they do get anyone that has had any kind of experience or contact with extraterrestrials to come and brief them onto what has happened. And an interesting confirmation of that is the case of Enrique Rincon from Colombia, who was flown to what appears to have been Langley, or the CIA headquarters, to basically brief the CIA as to what was happening with his contacts with extraterrestrial visitors in Colombia. So I think that this happens quite often, that agencies at a kind of official level quietly will seek out these contactees and have them brief them as to what exactly is occurring.
What can you tell us about Daniel Fry?
Well, Daniel Fry is very significant because he was a technician at White Sands Air Force Rocket Base, and he worked with the company Aerojet Corporation, and so he had a very responsible job. And so he says that sometime during his work there at White Sands, a missile base, that he actually met with an extraterrestrial, and this extraterrestrial revealed to Daniel Fry the mission of the extraterrestrials, which was to essentially integrate upon the Earth, establish a presence here, establish an identity, get whatever documents they needed so that they could fit in without being identified by the population, and that they asked Fry to assist them in that process. And what makes Fry credible is because he did work with a very well-known aerospace corporation, who was a technician at White Sands Missile Base. So that meant that this was not someone who was making up a tall story without any fear of the consequences, that if he was making up anything, if he was embellishing this, that he could have suffered severe financial loss because his position was such a responsible one. But he certainly is someone that I think also needs to be taken seriously, and certainly Timothy Good regarded him as credible, and Timothy Good interviewed him on a number of occasions, examined his evidence, and also concluded that Daniel Fry was a credible source of information on extraterrestrials visiting us.
Well, I got to tell you, the fact that he believes that the extraterrestrials were coming and he obtained these documents for them, it was almost like he was a spy.
Well, in a sense, he was recruited by them, and one of the things that they needed assistance with was to be able to fit in to normal life, and that was something he agreed to do. Now, whether or not he thought about the consequences of this, because, I mean, in a sense, from a national security perspective, you would be giving aid to a foreign entity. But he thought it was the ethical thing to do. I mean, he didn't feel that this was something that made him in any sense unpatriotic, and he certainly did assist these extraterrestrials. And I think he, like many of the contactees, very quickly worked out that the government was aware of this, but were keeping it under wraps and keeping it secret from the public. And so I think he was personally offended or disagreed with that policy. And I think just as many whistleblowers disagree with government policy of strict secrecy concerning all things extraterrestrial, I think people like Daniel Fry make a decision to assist these extraterrestrials, who they regard as being very peaceful, not in any way being a threat to the United States. And so Daniel Fry agreed to assist the extraterrestrials.
Isn't it strange, though, Michael, how they could just physically fit right in?
Well, this is really the thing that was most amazing for me, because when I began doing this research back in 2001, it was only after listening to Stephen Greer's press conference with all the witnesses that I became interested in this phenomenon. And initially, I really looked at a lot of the abductee reports, because that was really what was covered by most researchers, and I thought these were the most credible, and so I spent most time on those cases. And so I really, it wasn't until much later that I got to learn about these human-looking extraterrestrials that the contactees spoke about. And so that was something that was really intriguing, because then that made possible this process of them integrating with us. And there is reference to this in official documents as well. Robert Dean, who worked, as you know, at SHAPE headquarters in Europe from 1963 to 1967.
He was the real deal, right?
Definitely. A very credible person. He worked at NATO. He worked in the Supreme Headquarters Operations Center and as the person in charge of the roster for the intelligence team there. And he did have access to a top-secret document called the assessment, and the assessment described four different extraterrestrial groups that were visiting the Earth. They described the Greys, the Reptilians, and they also described a human-looking race that was so much like us that they could just fit in and integrate into human society, that they could walk the halls of NATO without being seen, and indeed could even be in the White House and not be recognized. This was something that, according to Dean, that really freaked out the generals.
Do you believe that story?
I think Dean is credible. I really believe that of all the whistleblowers I have either interviewed or read their testimonies, I would say that Dean and Corso are the two whose documentation is impeccable. And they have really solid backgrounds. And I think you can take everything that Robert Dean and Philip Corso said as really being 100% accurate. There was no funny business with them in terms of, you know, possible tampering of their minds or memories. I think that these were individuals that were just recalling things as they happened, and I think Robert Dean's testimony is very, very accurate and should be taken seriously.
Why the infiltration? What do they want?
Well, I think it may have to do with the development of these very powerful nuclear weapons that could destroy life on the planet. I think when we look at the evidence of Eisenhower meeting with extraterrestrials who were concerned about the hydrogen bombs, Adamski meeting with extraterrestrials who were saying the same thing, and you have similar sorts of encounters and testimonies talking about the extraterrestrials being concerned about nuclear weapons, I think that they decided to integrate themselves or infiltrate into human society because they really were concerned that the direction we were heading was going to result in us at some point getting into some nuclear war, that there would be a war between the Soviet Union and the US that would basically obliterate life on the planet using nuclear weapons. And I think the extraterrestrials really thought this was such a threat that they would infiltrate as much as they could to try to raise our consciousness, to make us aware of the issues, and prevent that kind of destructive outcome ever occurring.
Well, Michael, are you saying that they look so much like us, or we look so much like them, that we can't tell who they are, so they could be your neighbors?
This is exactly right. They could be living right next door to you. They could be a workmate. They could be someone that you know very well, who basically has fitted into human society for the purpose of helping educate, uplift humans about the extraterrestrial presence or about a more spiritual, ethical approach to life, and certainly make us aware of the dangers of nuclear weapons, environmental degradation, the importance of treating one another with greater dignity and respect, that all of these things seem to be part of the mission that the extraterrestrials have. And so certainly, yes, like you said, George, they could be your next-door neighbor and you wouldn't even know it.
Some people say that they sometimes see people who help them, but they're kind of strange, a bit distant, looking awkward, sort of weird. I wonder if they might be those kinds of extraterrestrials.
Well, I think that's the kind of clue you would look for, someone who doesn't quite fit in. There's something odd about them. I mean, and this has happened certainly. I have encountered certain individuals that have led to those feelings in me. I'm not quite sure. I can't say definitely I have or haven't met any extraterrestrials living amongst us, but I have met some individuals that I suspect maybe, but they haven't divulged that to me.
Well, we'll continue our chat with Michael Sala, and then next hour we'll open up the phone lines. And if any of you believe that you have seen one of these extraterrestrials, definitely check in with us next hour. Michael's latest book, Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence, is order number. There is a website. They're all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. But for those of you who are driving around and you have a great memory, exopolitics.org, or here's the toll-free order phone number, 800-816-7899. That's 800-816-7899. Who is Robert Renard, Michael?
Well, Robert Renard is a contactee that Wendell Stevens has done some research on, and this contactee claims to have met with a group of extraterrestrials from the planet Corendor who have been part of this phenomenon whereby they have integrated onto the planet and have been doing this in order to help lift the consciousness of humanity, as they claim, so that we would avoid becoming not only a threat to ourselves through the development and use of advanced technologies for destructive purposes, but also to other extraterrestrial worlds. They certainly see us as being really a race that has used technology without having developed sufficient ethical responsibilities so that we can ensure that they're not used for negative purposes.
Now, he claims there's 150,000 human-looking extraterrestrials just here in the country, 30,000 in California. Is he pulling our leg?
Well, that's right. That's what he says he was told by his extraterrestrial from Corendor, that there are 30,000 in California alone that are part of this effort by not only the Corendorians, but also a number of other extraterrestrial races to really put their personnel on the ground to help educate the population about extraterrestrial reality. Because I think that what is happening is that there is some kind of time limit here, that there needs to be some kind of dramatic upturn in human consciousness and ethical development in order for us to be ready for something. Now, whether it's associated with 2012 or some other event, I'm not quite sure of that, but there does seem to be this kind of accelerated effort by other extraterrestrial races to help humanity get up to speed as to who we are and the relationship we have with other races.
Why do it under the shroud of secrecy, Michael?
Well, this is something that again and again is raised by various contactees, that the government has decided at through its own covert processes not to disclose this information, that the government perceives this to be some kind of national security threat. And I think what it boils down to is that if the government was exposed, and here I'm talking about only that part of the government which is in the loop, because not all parts of the government know about this.
No, I agree with that.
So only that part which is in the loop is making decisions about when and how to release this information. And I think that they have decided that if they were to disclose the reality of extraterrestrials visiting us from all over the galaxy, and some of these extraterrestrials look so much like us that they could be our next-door neighbor, that they would very quickly lose control, because these extraterrestrials have a much more ethical, much more spiritually oriented approach to life, and that they do very positively view, say, some of the key tenets of Christianity concerning raising the consciousness to be at one with a kind of universal order. And so they are much more inclined to promote a spiritual message that would be welcomed by a lot of the population. And I think because many of those in these senior positions in government and military and so forth see themselves as really not being in any way ethically oriented or ethically exemplary, that they think that they would lose control, and I think in a sense they would.
I would conclude then that none of these extraterrestrials might be running for political office, unfortunately.
No, I think that they would work with people to help the common person to be more aware of exactly what is going on, that the galaxy is full of life, that even within our own solar system there are life forms that exist, advanced intelligent life forms that use these planets as bases or as homes, and that they are visiting us as well, so that in that sense we are not alone, and that we need to wake up to the truth and not continue to have the government pull the wool over our eyes and just proceed as though we're the only advanced life form in the galaxy.
Tell us about Professor Hernandez.
Well, that's another case that Wendell Stevens has brought to public attention. This was a tenured professor at the University of Mexico who met with an extraterrestrial female by the name of Leia, who visited him while he was teaching at his class, at one of his classes, and eventually she confided in him who she was, that she was from the constellation of Andromeda, took him to her spacecraft, and he actually went up for a ride. And when he recorded all of this, the incredible information that she had and the experiences he had with her and the reality of the extraterrestrial presence, he wasn't quite sure what to do. So what he did was he confided in a very reputable Mexican journalist by the name of Zitha Rodriguez, who was at the University of Mexico pursuing another story concerning health issues, and so she was taken, she was asked to go into his office, and where he confided in her what had happened, because he knew that Zitha Rodriguez was also interested in UFO issues. And so she became the vehicle by which his information got out into the public realm, because eventually what happened was that he did actually begin to tell people what was occurring, and they simply locked him up, because for a tenured professor back in 1980 in Mexico to say that you're meeting with these extraterrestrials, and that one was a very attractive extraterrestrial female, certainly his family thought he was crazy. And so when the doctors who were treating him for a particular knee illness questioning him about how quickly his knee recovered, and he had said, well, it was because this extraterrestrial female assisted me. They consulted with his family. His wife was jealous that he was meeting with this extraterrestrial female. She thought he was making it up and that he was having an affair. So she said, well, he's crazy. Lock him up. And that's what happened. They locked him up for a month. Then he was released, and shortly after that, he disappeared and hasn't been seen again. Kind of very sad case. It shows just the risk credible professionals take in embracing this extraterrestrial phenomenon, because you are basically chastised by your peers, and people won't believe you who are in responsible positions. And if you don't have the support, you could find yourself in deep trouble, which is what happened to Professor Hernandez.
In your entire life, Michael, what has been one of the most fascinating UFO cases you've investigated or talked with people about?
Well, I would say that the one that really stands out is this incident concerning Valiant Thor at the Pentagon. I mean, that just intrigues me that an extraterrestrial was actually a guest of the Pentagon for a 3-year period, which, according to Frank Strangers, is what happened. Now, Frank Strangers will be coming to Hawaii in another 2 weeks to speak at a conference that I'm co-organizing here, and so we'll get to hear more of his story. But to me, it's the most amazing one, because it really shows the intersection between extraterrestrial visitation and the official effort to cover this up, but at the same time learn as much as possible from extraterrestrials and the contactees.
Amazing. Amazing indeed, Michael. Conferences, what's in store for you?
Well, the conference is titled Earth Transformation. We're looking at alternative science, new technologies, spirituality, dolphins, and exopolitics. So we're looking at all of these disciplines and getting people to connect the dots, because none of these things stand on their own. I mean, if you try to do the exopolitics work on your own, you're out there really not, you're preaching to the choir in a sense. And so one of the things we found was we need to kind of reach out to a broader audience who are open to different aspects and hopefully bring all this together so that people can understand that spirituality, new science, even dolphins, that this is all related to this extraterrestrial phenomenon that we're witnessing here. And so people can just go to the conference website, earthtransformation.com, and learn about our guests. And we've got quite a range of people, leading experts in new science and technology, as well as those doing the work in exopolitics and spirituality, to really present on these issues and bring it all together.
Let's go back just for a bit. The Dead Sea Scrolls, we didn't talk a lot about this. What does it have in that?
Well, one of the things about the Dead Sea Scrolls is that after their discovery in 1947, that the scholars were not allowed access to these scrolls, that they were very tightly monitored and controlled, translated at an excruciatingly slow process, and released even more slowly, so that even now, after over 60 years now, not all of the Dead Sea Scrolls have been released. Now, some of the Dead Sea Scrolls confirmed the reality of extraterrestrial visitation. For example, the Book of Enoch and the Book of Giants and the Book of Jubilees, these were all confirmed through the Dead Sea Scrolls, that these were extracts of all of these books were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and all of them talk to the fallen angels, or the Nephilim, which we now understand as extraterrestrials, their presence, the creation of these giants, that these were all part of an ancient phenomenon that we are now coming to grips with in the 21st century, of extraterrestrials visiting us. And so the Dead Sea Scrolls are important because they give us an idea of what the ancients did and how they viewed pretty much the same phenomenon that we are trying to grapple with now. And I think that once the Dead Sea Scrolls are released in their entirety, we will have a much better way of ascertaining exactly what happened in the past and how that can inform us correctly about what to do in the present.
Amazing. Michael, the phone calls I want to take next hour from people who might believe that they're living next to someone who might be an extraterrestrial. David Jacobs talks about the danger of extraterrestrials, that something very serious is afoot here. You don't seem to agree with that. How come?
Well, I think what we have here are different phenomena. One is those extraterrestrials who are very human-looking, who don't need our DNA, they don't need to kind of genetically upgrade themselves or genetically manipulate with humanity. Basically, they work through a process which is non-invasive and respectful. They try to get permission of any individuals they work with, and they try to raise consciousness by giving information, sharing their own spiritual worldview, and hopefully raising the awareness of people that they come into contact with. Now, the research David Jacobs has done, as with abduction research generally, is working with an entirely different group of extraterrestrials who work in a different way, who do use invasive mechanisms, who do believe in genetic manipulation and upgrades, and that do see benefit for themselves in terms of using the genetic material of humanity to create a hybrid race that could be a mechanism for their own soul consciousness, if you like, to be downloaded into this hybrid, which can then become a new race, kind of like it would be a way of them renewing themselves. And at the same time, it could offer, and this is where I think David Jacobs is arguing that there is a possible threat here, that this new hybrid race could offer a replacement for humanity, and so this is something that he sees as being a real threat. And so I think what we have here are two different phenomena, and they're happening at the same time. And I think the truth is that we need to be aware of the extraterrestrial presence in all its facets so that we can come up with fully conscious and informed solutions to this very real problem that we have.
Tell me about what you know about Nikola Tesla, who, I think was a brilliant man.
Well, Tesla is fascinating because, as everyone knows, he was the inventor of the AC current and of the wireless transmitter and a host of other inventions. What's less well known is that he worked with a Canadian by the name of Arthur Matthews, who lived in Quebec, and Arthur Matthews was, in fact, kind of like a disciple of Tesla. Otis Carr and Arthur Matthews, as far as my research has been able to determine, were the two people who worked closely with Tesla. Tesla passed on everything to them in terms of his awareness of spacecraft that could be developed for ferrying people throughout the solar system or elsewhere, and also in the development of communication devices with extraterrestrials. And so Arthur Matthews created, with the help of Tesla, what he called a Teslascope, which was a device for communicating with extraterrestrials. He did this with Tesla, so Tesla was actually part of this. Tesla went up and visited Matthews up in Quebec. He was part of this effort that Matthews was conducting to not only build a Teslascope, but also these towers for the wireless transmission of energy. And the fascinating thing about Matthews is that Matthews was also a contactee with a group of extraterrestrials who claimed to be from Venus. And the amazing thing that he was told by these extraterrestrials from Venus was that Tesla was one of them. That Tesla, back when he was born, I think it was 1856 from memory, that Tesla was in fact a baby, a Venusian baby that was given to his family to be raised as an ordinary human. So Tesla was, in fact, according to Matthews, a Venusian extraterrestrial.
That's an incredible story, Michael.
Well, I mean, it is an amazing story, but then when you read the things that Tesla could do, I mean, this was a man who would...
Oh, he was way ahead of his time.
He's a century ahead of everyone else, but the way he developed these technologies were just incredible. I mean, he would not do things the way conventional inventors or scientists would operate. He would do it all in his mind. He would create an idea or a project in his mind, and he would work on it in his mind. He would develop it and tinker it and test it in his mind. And then once he had tested it and found that it worked as his mind enabled him to do all this testing, then he would just develop it, and it would work perfectly. So this was someone who was unique. His method of inventing was so far out, so far ahead of everyone else, that a possible explanation is Matthews, which is that he was in fact someone from another world who somehow was raised here as an ordinary human, but in fact possessed the full abilities and intellect of an extraterrestrial.
What about Einstein?
I haven't come across anything on Einstein yet as to his extraterrestrial origins. I mean, I know Tesla had some disagreements with Einstein over the speed of light, and I think possibly that might suggest that Einstein was probably much more human than Tesla was.
But Tesla from Venus, huh?
Well, that's the amazing thing, and I mean, Tesla never actually said anything other than in his autobiography he made a kind of cryptic statement about his parents in terms of them being his Earth parents, and that was a kind of cryptic statement. Tesla himself, during his life, never said anything about being an extraterrestrial. I think quite rightly he recognized that he would just
Do you think he knew?
I think he did. He was communicating, according to Matthews, he was communicating with extraterrestrials through his telescope. I mean, as far as we know, I mean, as far as the conventional history says, is that while he received in 1905, he used his telescope and received these radio signals from what he perceived to be Mars, and that they were just kind of beeps, and that was it. Well, that was not the device that Matthews developed with Tesla, and that Matthews says that they actually had full radio transmissions with these extraterrestrials from Venus. And interestingly, this was also what Bob Renault did too. I mean, we mentioned Bob Renault and the Corendians. Bob Renault also established radio communications with extraterrestrials. And so if Matthews is correct, that means that Tesla and Matthews had established radio communications with extraterrestrials in the 1930s, and Tesla himself may have done it much earlier than that, but we don't have any record of that.
All right, Michael, stay with us. We're going to take your phone calls next hour. This has been a really fast night. General phone calls with Michael Sala, and those of you who think maybe you're living next to an alien from up there, you might want to check in with us as well. So we'll simply be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. How come Stephen Greer, Michael, is having so much trouble, you know, getting more of that word out? You know, he devoted a lot of time and resources on the Disclosure Project, but it's still not happening.
Well, I think it's just the media. He hit that brick wall of the media basically shutting down. You can get a lot of people interested in the whole phenomenon, but if the general media doesn't pick it up, then it really doesn't reach beyond a kind of audience that is already interested, and you kind of, in a sense, that's the preaching to the choir phenomenon. And really, to break through that, you need to get the mass media on board, and not only Stephen Greer, and many others that are trying to work on getting this information out. You know, many of us have been working, say, with Paul Hellyer, and even there, you can get a little bit of success, but it's only because Paul Hellyer has a certain amount of credibility, and very few people of his stature are willing to put their credibility on the line to say this is real. And because he's a Canadian, it means that the U.S. media are less interested in it.
All right, to the phones we go. Let's go first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Yes, hello. My name is Brian, and I'm from Area 52. No, Dallas, Texas, actually.
But close, Brian.
Yeah. Well, basically, earlier Michael mentioned that there were ET rulers in ancient Egypt and also in ancient Mesopotamia. I want to know, are there any indications that there were ET rulers in ancient China? Is there anything in the ancient literature from ancient China of there being possible, you know, god kings or, you know, the ET god kings that Michael described? I know he mentioned India earlier. And maybe you could also mention something about the calamity that wiped out the Indus Valley, or the Indus River Valley civilization that suddenly disappeared around, I think, 1700 years ago or 1700 BC.
Well, I don't have any information on the China connection there, Brian, but certainly I know that with India that there is a lot of information about the extraterrestrial presence. India is unique in that a lot of its Vedic culture has been preserved. I mean, among all the ancient cultures, the only one that has survived is India, and with China, I know much of it was wiped out, so we really don't know too much about those ancient myths. But certainly with India, there's a lot there, and you're quite right that there was devastation in India, suggesting that some of these advanced technologies were used in this kind of war between the gods, who in fact were different extraterrestrial groups. And I think what I would conclude is that essentially what we had were different extraterrestrial groups locating in different pockets, because when we look at the King's List from Sumeria and we look at the records of Manetho, what we have here are different records, different gods or different extraterrestrials. And similarly with India, I think we can conclude that this is a different set of extraterrestrials. So what we have here is a picture of different parts of the planet, different regions where you have these god kings who have a kind of limited role or regional control over certain populations. And certainly there were rivalries and conflicts, and Zechariah Sitchin described this in his Earth Chronicles series in terms of the wars between the gods. And I certainly know that there have been some questions about some of these sand deposits, glass deposits in certain areas of northern India, which suggest that there was an atomic war sometime in antiquity.
Okay, thanks for your response. Next up, let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Will. I was calling about the squirrels you were talking about earlier. Do they have anything to do with the bees that are dying too, or are they something else?
I would say that's something else. Michael, I'm not sure you're too familiar with the disappearing or dying bees.
I am familiar with it. I mean, I'm like everyone trying to guess what the phenomenon is, and at this stage I would kind of go for something like chemtrails, but I certainly am no expert on that.
Okay, very good. Let's move on to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello there. This is Thomas calling from Pleasanton, Texas. How are y'all?
Sure, fine.
You know, it's unreasonable to me that people would not believe in extraterrestrials if they believe in God, because by definition, would not our own God be an alien? And any of the prophets that were sent by him, they would also be aliens or extraterrestrials. And I have another comment, if you would speak of that or give your comments on one other thing, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure. We'll keep you up there.
Thank you.
Well, certainly when we look at some of the key passages in the book of Genesis, God is referred to in the plural as the Elohim, and then we see different passages, say chapter 6 from Genesis, that talks about the Nephilim mating with the daughters of Eve, and of course the book of Enoch also talking about the 200 fallen angels. Certainly then we can say that some of these gods or angels were in fact extraterrestrials, and if we were to work out exactly who the kind of supreme God is, I mean, whether it's Jehovah or some other entity, we might conclude that it may well be an extraterrestrial who was someone that was in command of the entire extraterrestrial project for Earth. So, for example, in the case of the Sumerian texts, Anu was the supreme God based on the homeworld of Nibiru, so he may be, in the Sumerian tradition, regarded as the supreme god, but he was an extraterrestrial.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, my other comment is this. I'm an amateur astronomer, and I would encourage anybody that could afford to go out and get the best telescope you can, and this is why. When you look out there and you see the vastness of space, and you understand that it takes 200 billion years for our solar system to make one revolution around the Milky Way, the first instinct is the old cliche, boy, I sure feel small. But don't look at it that way. Look out there in space and realize how big we are, because we came from that, and we are part of that. We are out there, and they are in us. So, you know, if people would look at it that way, that we're so, you know, small and you know, unimportant, that's not true. We are as large as the whole universe, however large it may be. It's all interconnected. It all relies on itself. I have a theory as to why we may be visited, and they don't want us to destroy this planet. It's because everything is in perfect balance, or needs to be in balance. And if we were to destroy this planet, literally, it could potentially throw the whole balance out and create a domino effect throughout the whole universe.
I can comment a little bit about that. I mean, one of the conceptions we have is that the universe is this vast entity, and that to travel from one part of the universe in our galaxy to another would just take enormous energy and time, and so therefore it makes the universe seem so much bigger. But if technology exists for faster than light speed travel, then of course the universe becomes much smaller. I mean, if we can, for example, instantly teleport from one part of the galaxy to the other, all of a sudden then the galaxy and even the universe becomes kind of like our backyard. And this is something that's not so far beyond the imagination. I mean, there is an individual who's come forward that has said that he was part of an effort to develop a civilian spacecraft back in the 1950s and in 1960, and that was pioneered or headed by Otis Carr, who was a protege of Nikola Tesla, and that this person who's come forward, Ralph Ring, claims that he was one of the three pilots that tested this vehicle that was being developed to travel to the moon at light speed and above. And that the belief was that you could actually travel faster than light, and this vehicle was more or less a kind of teleportation spacecraft. So Ralph Ring is actually going to be one of the speakers at our forthcoming conference here in Hawaii, and I think he's got this very important contribution to make, that civilians, even without enormous resources, can actually get together, collaborate on developing these spacecraft that are capable of faster than light speed travel. And he's got really amazing information, and I recommend people to go visit the conference website to find out more about him and what he's got to contribute. And certainly I think the universe, while it's big, if we develop the technology, we can really go anywhere.
Michael, are you sure there's not some kind of nefarious reason for this, for their visits?
I think that extraterrestrials have been involved in the establishment of the human presence on this planet. I think probably the reasons vary. I think some may have established humanity here as a kind of experiment to see how we would evolve. Some regarded us as a resource to be exploited. Some regarded us as having these incredible gifts that we could develop in a kind of hostile environment with competing extraterrestrial groups here. I think there can be many reasons. I think we really can't just conclude that the extraterrestrial presence is something that's a threat to us. I think it's multifaceted, and it's in a sense it's kind of like the cup is half full or half empty. It's like, how do you regard this? And ultimately, I think it does become something like that, where we can look at the extraterrestrial presence. Is it something that signifies our life is half full and we should be thrilled about what that means? Or is it something that signifies the cup is half empty and we need to be worried about losing more?
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on the air with Michael Sala. Hi there.
Hi, guys. This is Bob calling you from Maui.
Yes, Bob.
Yeah, it's really a pleasure to talk to both of you. It's very interesting. I wanted to tell Michael that in the late 50s, I worked for Aerojet General in Azusa at the same time that Daniel Fry was there. And I have some additional information you might be interested in, Michael. Dan left there right around 59, if I remember right, and opened up a company in Hesperia, California, which is maybe 50 miles north of Azusa, where Aerojet was. And he started building flying saucers. And this was something that he was told, or he got the information from these contacts that you had mentioned that he had while he was working up for Aerojet in White Sands. And I had, on occasion, I would go up there and go to his plant, and I went through it, and it was really interesting. He had saucers, they were the typical flying saucer type, like two pie plates, you know, put on top of each other with a little canopy on top. And they were somewhere around 20 to 35 feet in diameter. And he had one sitting out in front of the factory, kind of up on metal stilts, the way you'd mount a fighter plane in front of a fighter, manufacturer's plant. And then inside, he had them in various stages of development. I never got to see one fly. I don't think they ever did, because Aerojet transferred me up to the Sacramento facility, and I worked for them for 16 years, and I had very high-level clearances. At the time, I I saw Dan's plant. I was just a very young engineer, and I didn't have too much knowledge. But then later on, I got to work on some programs that really made me an expert on that type of thing, not on flying saucers, but on spacecraft. And the reason that I became so interested in flying saucers, and this is something that I had never told anyone all the time I was working for Aerojet, because I thought they would think I was a nut and would let me go. In 1959, when I was a young man, just started working for Aerojet, I had a 56 Corvette, and I was down at the Santa Anita drag strip in Santa Anita, California, with two friends. We were racing our cars, and I was on a creeper underneath my buddy's 57 Chevy working on something. As I was crawling back out, I looked up, and over the buildings in Santa Ana was a flying saucer. And I'm not kidding you. It was daylight. It was 11 o'clock in the morning. It was easy to see. And I pulled on my buddy's pant leg, and I said, "You're not going to believe what I'm looking at." They both looked at it. They both saw it. It moved very slowly for about 3 or 4 minutes across the horizon, and then it just shot straight up out of sight almost instantaneously. There was no kind of aircraft at that time that we made that could do that. So I've always believed in them. It's just like our belt. Once you've seen it, you never forget it. And I just thought I'd pass that along to you.
And I envy you, because I still haven't seen my very first one. What about you, Michael? Have you?
I've seen something here on the Big Island of Hawaii here. I've seen some lights that certainly behave in a way that look like UFOs. I mean, they're not satellites. I mean, this is typically at night. I've seen things. Also saw some things at James Gilliland's ranch up there at Mount Adams that also pulsed, and that weren't satellites. So I know that they're definitely visiting us, but it's hard when you see lights in the sky and people are looking for the kind of daylight shot of a metallic craft, and they want more than just a light, and certainly it's something important. And Bob actually raised a really significant issue there, that is that Daniel Fry actually worked on the development of a flying saucer craft himself, because I mentioned Ralph Ring. He worked with Otis Carr, who actually went to the meetings that Daniel Fry was establishing there. He had a group called Understanding, where people discussed these advanced principles, because Daniel Fry, being a kind of aeronautical technician, he also was putting out books on the principles for the spacecraft and how the extraterrestrials who visited him, how they developed or built their craft. So he was putting this information out, and so he helped people like Otis Carr, who were developing their own plants up there at around the same time. So it's really interesting that Bob visited the plant that Daniel Fry had built up there. I'd love it if you could send me an email with your contact. I'd like to talk to you more about that, and maybe get you to talk to Ralph Ring, who I'm sure would be interested to hear about that.
There's an interesting website, danielfry.com, by the way, that is pretty fascinating, Michael. Have you checked that out?
I have, and yes, he certainly is someone that experienced a really profound event with the extraterrestrials that he met with, and it really transformed his life, and he put out a lot of information to really help people understand how the extraterrestrials operated, what they were doing here, and he put out some very credible manuals on how to build your own craft. And I think people who are sufficiently gifted to develop these kinds of technologies would benefit to go to his website and check out his books on extraterrestrial propulsion systems.
Died in 1992, but man, he knew a lot when he was at White Sands. Absolutely incredible. Well, Michael, where do people get the book, Exopolitics?
People can go to the website, or they can just go to Amazon.com and they can find the book there.
Do you believe there's any collusion, Michael, between other nations with regards to the UFO situation? Michael?
Yes, hi, George.
There you go. I thought you were abducted for a moment.
Well, I think there has been collusion, George, between the Soviet Union, or Russia as it's now known, and the U.S. when it comes to the possibility of the planets in our solar system holding extraterrestrial life. Both countries have sent a succession of space probes and landings to the Moon, to Mars, to Venus, and all have returned data suggesting that these planets and the Moon are inhospitable to life. Well, I think there has been collusion to actually hide the truth that, in fact, these planets do not prove to be inhospitable to life, that there is atmosphere on the Moon, on Mars, that is sufficient, and that even the data that was given back concerning from the Mariner missions and the Venera missions to Venus, that all of this has to be called into question given the testimony of a number of disclosure witnesses that the data concerning the possibility of life on the Moon and Mars has been tampered with systematically.
Let's go back to the phones. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Sean. I'm calling from Eagle Mountain, Utah.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, well, basically, I worked for one of the most major contractors for aerospace and defense technology in the world for several years, and what I've seen in my time doing that is a lot of military aircraft that would account for several UFO sightings that have happened globally. That's slightly beside the point. What my main question is, these claims of extraterrestrials being responsible for these aircraft or being the ones actually piloting these extraterrestrial so-called aircraft, and the involvement within humanity of extraterrestrials now and in the past, all these claims that I hear, such as, you know, as Michael has said, or previous callers and other times that I've heard the show, I've never seen anything ever in my life that would point to any extraterrestrial origin of anything whatsoever. Yet on shows like this and elsewhere, online, magazines, books, newspapers, I constantly hear these claims that, oh, extraterrestrials are regularly visiting Earth and have been for hundreds or thousands of years. My question is, where's the evidence for this?
Well, the best evidence we have are the testimonies of the people who have had these kinds of experiences, who in some cases have a very solid background, whose claims have been investigated, and so that's why people such as George Adamski, Menger, Dan Fry, the classic 1950s contactees are such important cases, because their evidence was scrutinized, very closely scrutinized for decades, and researchers have looked at the evidence, spoken to witnesses who confirm this. So as I mentioned earlier, with George Adamski, there were six witnesses to his first encounter. Plus, there was physical evidence, photographs, film that he provided. So this is all physical data, and I'm sure many people can cast doubt on this data. They can say, well, maybe they were hallucinating. Maybe Adamski put the people up to it. But, I mean, credible researchers went and interviewed each of these witnesses in the Adamski case, and they confirmed what they saw and that Adamski wasn't hoaxing this. And then you have a number of other cases, the Billy Meyer case, many, many photos of the UFOs, many other contactees are very credible. And even today we have more contactee cases. There's a breaking story in Italy at the moment with this contactee by the name of Maurizio Cavallo. Paola Harris is covering that case. She's got photographs. She's got witnesses who have seen the UFOs. So I recommend maybe getting Paola to come along and talk about that case. But, I mean, there's a lot of evidence there, so I would disagree that there's nothing supporting extraterrestrial visitation.
Well, and in the old days, Michael, we did have incredible evidence of landing sites. Remember the burned-out round circles and I have a friend, I've mentioned this story before, a reporter back in the 70s in St. Louis. He went out to Ellsbury, Missouri, covered a story of UFO sightings, saw cows walking around a burned-out circle. There was one dead cow in the middle. The others would not go in the circle. Saw thousands of dead flies scorched to the side of a tree. That's strange stuff, but it's hard evidence.
Well, that's right. I mean, anything that's left behind by extraterrestrial vehicles, I mean, that helps support these witness testimonies. And certainly there have been so many cases of that. And the Connie Zamora case from Socorro, I think it was 1964, who was a New Mexico state trooper. I mean, he, very credible person, and he saw the evidence in terms of the UFO landing, and his peers, some fellow police officers came along afterwards, and they saw the traces of the extraterrestrials that had been left behind. So definitely many other cases support that extraterrestrials do leave some evidence behind in the form of burnt grass vegetation and depressed vegetation in the area that they've landed.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jamila from Las Vegas. Hi. And I am calling because I believe that my son's father was not of this world. And
oh, really? Tell us more.
Well, to me, it's just a strong feeling that I had very soon after meeting him. He almost, I don't know what to tell you except that he seemed strangely innocent and sometimes kind of shocked to be here. I knew almost nothing about UFOs. He taught me amazing things about, you know, our history of extraterrestrial contact, about UFOs. He had an incredible knowledge of metaphysics and taught me, healed me in many ways, you know, energetically, raised my consciousness. His eyes were just extremely unusual. His feet and ankles, the structure, I can't point to anything particularly and say it was, you know, that it looked unhuman, but my sense of it,
could he have been deformed?
No, it wasn't
nothing
anything
like that.
Like that. No, nothing like a clear deformation, but something just to me that seemed odd, out of place, but I couldn't.
What kind of person was he?
He was very gentle, very playful, very, very otherworldly. Very metaphysical, very, you know, had little altars to fairies around and statues of, you know, gods and goddesses. Very interested in spirituality. A very peaceful, very loving person.
I would ask, Samela, did your son or did the father display any kind of telepathic abilities or psychic abilities that stood out?
The father? Yes. Yes. I was considering moving to somewhere out, to another city without, you know, and I hadn't said anything to him about it, but I heard through a friend, he told a friend of mine that he said, oh, she's planning to move to so-and-so, and I hadn't said anything about it to either of those people. And, you know, there were several other instances that, yeah, he had an ability to telepathically gather information. Absolutely. Very psychic.
Well, I'd appreciate it if communicated later and I could get more information from you. It's a fascinating case. It reminds me of the Elizabeth Clara case. She was a South African lady who in 1954 met with an extraterrestrial from Proxima Centauri, and they actually fell in love, and they actually did have a child. They had a son, because it was too dangerous for him to be raised here on the Earth, various governments were trying to abduct her during her pregnancy, that it was decided that the son would be raised off-planet. But certainly reminds me of that case, so I would appreciate if you contacted me, gave me your email details. Or
I'd like to see a picture of what this individual looks like. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, gentlemen. This is James calling from Brooklyn, New York.
Hey, James.
And I have a question, I guess, from an anthropological or a mythological point of view. I was wondering if your guest knows anything about extraterrestrial mythology in ancient Swiss or Helvetian culture, and also the name of the planet that he mentioned, Corendor. There's a town in one of the southern provinces or cantons in Switzerland by the same name, although it's pronounced Corinador, and I believe that's in Valais. And I would be most interested in that because, you know, this also might have some effect on the fact that, I guess, or maybe some parallel reason why Billy Myers was contacted in Switzerland. And I wonder if you could kind of like go into that a wee bit. Thank you.
All right, thanks. What do you think of the Billy Meyer case?
Well, I think Billy Meyer is someone that is genuine. I think people who have investigated him, Wendell Stevens, Lee Elders, have looked at the case very dispassionately and objectively, and I think that they've found enough there that support Meyer being a genuine contactee. Nevertheless, Meyer, as all contactees, generates a certain group around him that becomes controversial, and I think there's a difference between the contactee and the kind of organization that's surrounded the Meyer case. So I would say Meyer is genuine, but the group that's formed around him may exhibit very strange behaviors. It makes it difficult for researchers to get to really speak with Billy Meyer directly rather than having to go through these filters.
Like Michael Horn, I guess, huh?
Well, ideally you want to go directly to the source.
Sure.
And one of the things about Billy Meyer, according to Wendell Stevens, is that he was someone that really wasn't in favor of any kind of hierarchy. He wasn't in favor of appointing people to special positions. He was a very humble man. And I think part of the Meyer message is one of not establishing hierarchies. But inevitably, when you have an organization, you have a hierarchy, you have different people appointed to different positions, and so kind of ego comes in and the possibility of compromise and infiltration comes in. So I think these things have kind of come into the Meyer case and made it difficult for researchers to really do justice to what Billy Meyer has done. And for example, a lot of his contact literature still hasn't been translated into English.
Let's take some final calls. Wildcard line, it's your turn. Hi there.
Hey, George. Michael, this is Patrick calling from Virginia.
Hey, Patrick.
I'm trying to get my thoughts here together. Last week you had a female, I want to say doctor, maybe scientist, talking about space being finite, not infinite. You know, I'm drawing a blank on her name. She's very adept on the topic, and she just stated that, and one of her analogies was if you left Earth and you just traveled in one direction, this is her point about space being finite, that eventually you'd come back to Earth, you know, and she really didn't say it was a circle or anything like that, but just that, you know, our universe wasn't necessarily just going on and on. And just on that topic and then the subject you guys are talking about, you know, my idea has always been that aliens, you know, they seem to awfully human at times, two arms, two legs, things like that. That what is the possibility of, you know, extraterrestrial alien life form actually being of human nature, possibly future humans who you know master the time travel or some of that sort, and are, you know, literally maybe coming back and revisiting us again. And you know, I know sometimes they talk about the humans the aliens being in like their bodies by decaying or anything like that. And it just, you know, again, I just always was curious about how, you know, why aren't they just, you know, two arms, two legs, two eyes. They just seem very human-like. And I'm thinking the size of the universe and everything like that, that, you know, an alien could be anything. And so that always just brought me back to the same focus point that, you know, they could just be us in the future, I guess, visiting us and maybe looking for answers, looking for help for problems they're dealing with in the future.
There's always been that theory that they may be us, Michael, coming back.
That's right. Thanks for that question, Patrick. It does really bring us to this issue of time, and how easily can time be manipulated? Can the extraterrestrials be us from the future? And I think definitely, especially when we look at some of the people who are working on the technology, the propulsion technologies of extraterrestrial vehicles, the anti-gravity in particular, often there is this relationship between the generation of electromagnetic energy and an anti-gravity pulse. And as we know from Einstein's general theory of relativity, the strength of a gravitational field does distort time-space. So in other words, if you develop the technology for space travel at above light speed, then you also have the technology for manipulating time. And so that would definitely suggest that there is a real possibility that many of these extraterrestrials, or some of them at least, are coming from the future, whether they're from our future or the future of other planets, whether it's the Pleiades or Venus or whatever, that's very much a possibility.
Next up, first-time caller line, you're up with us very quickly. Go ahead, please.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is Brandon from Shreveport, Louisiana. I was just wondering, I didn't quite hear everything you said about the Dead Scrolls earlier, but what I kind of heard was something about us not having or not having access to all the information out of there, and I was kind of wondering who has that and what information is available and what information is contained within those scrolls.
Well, Branton, there were a number of caves that had these scrolls that were discovered from Qumran from 1947, and the cave in particular where the least amount of information has been released is the fourth cave, and there's a particular organization in Israel, and I don't remember the exact title, but a kind of historical antiquities center that has charge of these scrolls, and they're not releasing it, and I think that the reason is quite obvious, that it threatens the mainstream religions in terms of the conventional understanding of who we are, because we need to remember that mainstream religion has been kind of very parsimonious as to exactly what texts to include into their canon for their traditional followers. And so, for example, the Book of Enoch was excluded from the canon of the current Hebrew or Israeli biblical belief system and Christianity, and even though in the time of Jesus the Book of Enoch was regarded as one of the traditional sources. And when you look at the information in the Book of Enoch in terms of the fallen angels, the Nephilim, and 200 of them being here and being responsible for all of these problems that humanity was experiencing, then it raises this kind of extraterrestrial dimension into exactly why we are here, what the problems are humanity is experiencing, and what the future is. And that is something that I think challenges the conventional religious institutions.
His name is Dr. Michael Sala, and he's been talking about exopolitics, the alien agenda as well. Exopolitics, the book, is available at 800-861-7899, or go to his website, exopolitics.org. And pick up something that will just blow your mind. Michael, thanks for being on the program, my friend.
Thank you for having me, George. I've enjoyed it again, and I look forward to the next time.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.